Miss Seiler, you've been on the West End stage as recently as only about a year ago when you finished a long run in Arsenic and Old Lace with Sybil Thorndike. And you were on the West End stage as long ago as 1909 when you played your first West End part. So there's a very long gap between the two, nearly 60 years. But let's be conventional and begin at the beginning. And to someone just looking at your potted biography as it exists in many places, your beginning looks very unconventional in that I think you were an undergraduate at Bedford College in London. Were you there knowing that you wanted to be an actress, or did this come later?
Well, you know, I always knew I wanted to be an actress since I was seven, and made my first appearance, I think, when I was seven. But my parents had a mistaken idea that I was a musician. It was really because they loved music themselves. So I was put down to try and learn the piano, which was a complete and obvious failure. And then I did what I think many Victorian young ladies did. I was so anxious to go on the stage. I was so frustrated. I was so dull in my little suburban surroundings, longing to go on the stage and being thwarted at every turn, that I went into a decline. Now, you've heard about a decline, haven't you? Well, I can tell you exactly what a decline is. It's sheer boredom. And I really was getting quite ill. So my mother and father had known William Archer, the great critic. And it was he who was to give advice as to whether I was to go on stage. And I suppose I said my little piece. And he gave a favourable verdict. And I was allowed to try to get into the RADA.
And so you turned up at RADA and did an audition there.
Oh, dear, yes. I took the examination a fortnight after everybody else had. And I can remember sitting in a room waiting. I had a beige coat, I can see to this day, with short sleeves and long black gloves, in which I thought I looked awfully smart. But I didn't know whether one recited Shakespeare in gloves or without gloves. And so finally, after really forgetting what I was going to do in this agony of spirit, I took off one glove and was then called in to recite before Sir John Hare, Sir Arthur Bernero, Sir Squire Bancroft, and the principal of the Academy, Mr. George Bancroft. It was a pretty good galaxy of stars. To recite my Shakespeare looking rather like a zebra, with one long white arm and one black. So then they asked me who had taught me my little bit of Shakespeare. It's the only bit of Shakespeare I ever remember with any certainty at all.
What was it?
It was Rosalind. It was the scene when she scolds Phoebe. And they asked me who taught me, and of course nobody had taught me. Oh, but I've forgotten to tell you. That I had an interview with Mr. George Bancroft in order to take my examination. Well, you know, in those days, everybody was very beautiful on the stage. It was practically, I suppose it was universal that any actress was lovely to look at. And I came into the room as this plain little girl, little schoolgirl. Well, I was older than that, really, but still. And he took one look at me and said, "Now, Miss Seiler, before we say anything else, I'm going to tell you that obviously you have no qualifications for the stage at all." So I, being rather wise beyond my years, I think, said, "Oh, I know what you mean, Mr. Bancroft. You mean that I'm very plain. Well, I do know this, but I think if you'd let me recite to you, you'd think perhaps I would have some use on the stage. That is why I got my audition."
And you won your audition and got in there and spent your years there. Before that, one would have had to acquire one's craft merely by joining some actor manager's company as a young girl, would one?
Yes.
There was no other school.
Yes, one tagged on in a touring company. Well, I say tagged on. How rude to Mr. Benson, who had this wonderful touring company, and many others there were. Of course, the days of the stock companies were over by the time I joined, and there was nothing like a repertory company. So one got a job holding a sword or just coming on, and not saying the carriage waits, because they nearly all did great big gorgeous romantic stuff. But of course, you see, I missed all that out.
Well, to follow you on, you won your gold medal, and then within months of that, early 1909, you were already in The Truants. Was it the lead in The Truants that you played?
It was the ingenue lead. And it was my first time of, as they used to say, treading the boards. It's a nice expression, really. And I'd never faced an audience in my life. And I remember saying to somebody, just before I went on, is there anything or anybody to stop me running out of the stage door and going home? And I was rather calmed by whoever I said it to. And Lena Ashwell sent me up a little salvolatile. That seems to be of the period, too. And I went on for my first entrance. Well, I got a big laugh in about my third speech. And you see, I'd never heard a laugh from the back of the stage, from behind the footlights before. And perhaps you know what it sounds like. It doesn't sound exactly like a laugh. It has a curious quality of its own. And it so frightened me, I thought the scenery was falling down. But I didn't stop, I went on. And then gradually I began to realize that this extraordinary noise was a response of the audience, which was a nice start to one who's tried to evoke that noise all the years that she's been on the stage.
And were you, as they still say, an overnight success?
Well, you know, I was, yes. All the papers, I think, were immensely complimentary. I didn't see many, because, you see, we were a very funny little suburban family. My mother, by this time, my father had died, my mother and myself, and we didn't know about buying papers and looking. So one had rather to wait until people wrote and said. I was such a little ignorant and, oh, dear, cloistered kind of a little girl that I'm sure I didn't take any advantage of this at all. But I had interviews with journalists, of course, and photographs taken, a great many photographs, frightful photographs. If I look at them now, I can't believe that anyone allowed me onto the stage at all. But it wasn't a very glamorous life for beginners and young people in those days. At least it wasn't for me. I suppose that was because from the very word go, I was a character actress. I'm afraid I was called that clever at the Inisal, you know. It's the most beastly word, and it's haunted me all my life. I'd much rather have been that fascinating, exquisite, magnetic woman that I fear I've never been.
Well, I think it's all involved in clever. I know what you mean, but I don't share your dissatisfaction with it. I imagine from what you say of it that The Truants was a fairly conventional play, but 2 years later you were in The Bluebird. This, in retrospect, looks fairly unconventional. I don't know whether it seemed so then, but Maeterlinck has a sort of strange, rather way-out quality. Was it an advanced play to be in?
Well, there's quite a nice story about that. I had a contract for 3 years with Charles Hawtrey after The Truants to play the leading parts. At £10 a week, going up, I think, after 3 years to possibly 18. And this was the plum in any actress's lap, if you put a plum in your lap. Anyway, I developed erysipelas from having bathed in Normandy and hit my leg on a rock. And I never fulfilled this contract at all. Well, now, I got better, and 6 months out of an actress's life when she's at the very start is absolutely fatal. Nobody had remembered me at all. So I started writing to everybody, and I had a little form letter. I used to write, "Dear Mr. So-and-so, this is just to remind you that I am plain but serviceable," which was a little phrase we used to use in draper shops when one was buying length of stuff for a dress. So I got a response from the Haymarket Theatre, where they were going to put on a revival of The Bluebird, which I'd seen the year before, with Ina Pelle playing the part of water and dancing. And I had a little letter saying, "Would I go to an audition? And would I please dance for them and recite?" Well, I didn't dance, you see, and I couldn't recite. So when I got there, I was horrified to find all these little girls and that tutu and the whole thing doing wonderful steps and executing marvellous pirouettes and people spouting the front stage, and I stood very miserably in my outdoor clothes, and when they called Miss Seiler, I went out of the footlights and said, "It's so kind of you to ask me to come, but I have to explain that I don't dance and I can't recite, but thank you very much indeed." And it so happened that the producer had been a teacher of mine at the RADA, so he said, "Have you ever seen the Blue Bird?" And I said, "Yes, last year I saw it." Well, you know what's required of this part? Oh, well, I remember, I said, "Very well, Miss Pelly playing the part." Well, they said, "Let the lady at the piano play the dance and see what you should do." So I just enjoyed myself like fun. I gave an imitation of what I'd seen Ty Pelly doing, and as it didn't really matter one way or the other, I must have had an awfully good time. They had quite a good time, and within 10 minutes I was signing a contract at the back of the dress circle. So that's why I went into the Blue Bird.
And danced water for many months, did you?
Yes, yeah. Yes, and adored it. Yes.
Well, before we sort of move on through the First World War to a slightly different theatre between the wars, going back to when you were a 19-year-old at RADA, what sort of heroes did a drama student at that period have? I mean, looking to the professional theatre, who were the figures you most admired or envied?
Oh, as women actresses, Irene Vanbrugh was the top. Mary Tempest. Lillian Braithwaite, no, because she was much nearer my own age. There were the beauties like Evelyn Millard and people now that I'm very sure that you haven't heard of. And amongst the men, there was Owen Nairs, the matinee idol, and with whom I went into management later, and Geraldine Maurier, of course, I was his leading lady at one point, Charles Hawtrey, the most agreeable, amusing, delightful person in the world. These were the names that I remember. And you see, in those days, we weren't like the young folk are now, who call everybody by their Christian names. It took me a good 20 years to call Miss Vanbrugh Irene, and then I always felt rather astonished at myself when I did it. And we sat at their feet. We just thought they were too wonderful. And now I believe at the RADA, all the students have their own critical faculties, very well developed, and I shouldn't think they haven't that attitude towards the veterans on the stage at all. I don't go lately. I'm rather afraid of overhearing something which would puncture my pleasure in having been there as a girl.
But you say that nobody called each other by their Christian names. Was this a surface difference, or was there, in fact, a very much greater sort of formality within a company acting together in the West End?
Oh, but much greater formality. And much greater, what shall we say, good manners, and there was all this protocol, you see. I accepted parts with George Alexander, and I suppose Geraldine Maurier, without even reading the part, without reading the play, because if George Alexander was kind enough to offer me this part, I must imagine that I could play it well, and it was not for me to say whether I thought the part was good, bad, or whether I thought the play was good or bad. Now, even the understudies read the new plays, I believe, in theatres, and pass a good opinion or not. At the St. James's, I must tell you, George Alexander would rehearse a play for 6 weeks, and only in the mornings, because in the afternoons he and Lady Alexander went in their carriage and a pair, calling, or to Henley, or whatever it might be, and we waited for 6 weeks without any salary. Now, that, of course, is the other side, because in those days there was no equity. And the plays were little fashionable plays, easy to put on, easy to run. You could make a profit, you know, on half capacity in those days. At the St. James's Theatre, there were two staircases, the dressing rooms, one for the ladies and one for the gentlemen. And the housekeeper would come round on the first night, knock on the door and say, "You remember no smoking, please, don't you?" "Yes," we would say, hurriedly taking our cigarettes out of our mouth. And one really never saw Sir George, except just to say good evening before one went on.
Did this mean that rehearsals were a very formal affair too? I mean, now a rehearsal is very much a matter of trial and error and everyone trying to work something out together. Were they much more organised affairs in those days?
Well, you see, George Alexander started rehearsals with the entire set up, every prop, and all the men, stage staff there in white coats and white shoes with india rubber soles and white gloves. Nobody knew their words before they came to rehearsal. And you never had, I, for instance, would have started at the first rehearsal with not the play getting me, but with a little oblong book with just my part and cues, quite unilluminating cues, like, "Has it? Oh, no, my dear," and things like that, which I hadn't any idea what had gone before. And one counted the length of one's part by how many sides there were in one's dear little book. And then one had a pencil and wrote down what one was told to do.
And at what point did you first realise the sort of nature of the whole play? Just by finding out in rehearsal what did happen before your cue?
Yes, one watched very carefully and listened and looked and gathered what it was all about.
One of the greatest parts of your reputation is to do with your playing of Restoration Comedy, and I think you first played that in 1916 in The Double Dealer. Had you harboured an ambition to play this sort of play from studying it, or did it just happen that somebody asked you to?
No, it so happened I was asked. I think I've always been very unintelligent about my career. I've just done what people suggested I should do, thinking that mostly they knew better than I did. Of course, in those days, one laid the foundations of one's career in these Sunday night societies, which did classical plays which were not considered right for the commercial theatre, in fact, were never done. Even a great deal of Shakespeare was done by these special clubs, run by a lot of very brilliant intellectual people. And I was invited to play this part and was quite delighted to be in anything that wasn't just the teacup drama, of which I was getting a little tired. And it's a funny thing. One was looked at askance for having to say in these plays some rather, well, in those days, what shall we say, questionable things. And, of course, all the plays are a little, were a little questionable in those days. Nowadays, we take the whole thing in our stride. But it never worried me as a very protected and well-brought-up young woman to mind saying the things that I had to say. There were one or two of my seniors who said, "Oh, I can't say this, you know," and looked away. It never worried me for the reason that it was the accepted point of view in the days the play was written.
But many audiences at that time would have been unable to take it in this light, would they? They would have been deeply shocked by a Restoration dramatist, the ordinary West End audience.
Yes, I think they need it educating, you know. And, of course, the audiences nowadays are a thousand times better educated than anything we had in our youth, in every way, I think.
In the sort of period of 1909-10, when you were beginning, looking backwards from now, the greatest events of the time were really the activities of Shaw and Granville Barker at the Royal Court. Did these at the time seem something quite extraordinary and a sort of really impressive theatrical event, or did they merely seem part of what was going on?
I don't remember being absolutely impressed and excited. It was much more gradual than that. I went to see You Never Can Tell at the Royal Court Theatre, and one was charmed and delighted. Randall Barker's plays, one didn't see commercially for many years later, by the time one had got to know them well. Not quite so violently disrupting as the modern plays have been nowadays to the commercial theatre. No, I think they gentled themselves into our lives. They were never really very popular, and I suppose they didn't really make any money.
We've talked about your moving into restoration comedy, and I think in many people's minds, probably, you're most closely linked with restoration comedy and with a whole run of different West End modern comedies. But you have also, of course, done a great many Shakespearean parts at different times. Do you regard yourself as predominantly one sort of actress who's occasionally made sallies into other plays, or do you see yourself as something more varied?
Well, for about the first 20 or 30 years of my career, I played in every bad American farce that was ever put on in this country. And I always thought that I was engaged because I sometimes had a little gift of saying, pass the bread and butter, make it sound funny. It must have been something in the play. And I think it was very hampering to me, perhaps, as an actress with a career with a capital C. It was very useful for earning my living and keeping my mother. And for, let us be frank, enjoying myself. I didn't get a chance to play Shakespeare because, as you notice, I haven't got the kind of voice which speaks verse very happily. I wish to goodness I had. I don't speak verse well. Poetry, I love it, but I don't think it's for me. So I started Shakespeare very late in life, and then I've only played the comedy roles, obviously. I had a whack at Amelia. I say a whack, she had a whack at me. I'm afraid I didn't pull that off very well. My first commercial effort, or rather, kind of public effort at it, was Rosalind.
That's not really a comic role. It's a beautifully romantic role, I think.
I think she was a bit funny when I played her. But I do love her very dearly. She's my favourite lady, Rosalind. We played it in a very new, modern, and a shocking set by Lovett Fraser. Nigel Playfair put it on, and it shocked even the critics to the core. And the thought that I should be playing in Shakespeare had incidentally shocked them to the core. They called it Shimmy Shakespeare. If you know, there was a rather rude dance called the Shimmy Shake in those days. So that was a good little joke. At the same time, it was a lively, lovely, and I think romantic production. Nigel played in it, and Herbert Marshall, of later film fame. Dear Leslie Banks was in it. And I think we were all jolly good. We opened at Stratford-on-Avon, where we horrified them. And Benson was there at the same time. We were sort of sharing the weeks, and his company was there. And there was a kind of sides taken in the town against the modern production and for the old one. And there was a great ball given, I remember, to which we all went. And the great moment, which was almost breathtaking to everybody in the room, was when Benson came right across the floor, offered me his arm, and we set off dancing the waltz together. I think I winked over his shoulder, but the whole thing was resolved that night, and we all made friends.
What was so shocking about Lovett Fraser's set? I mean, what was it that put people on edge about it?
Well, you see, it wasn't realistic at all. It was what word would one use for it now? There were cut cloths for the trees. It was not symbolic. It was a little abstract, not realistic. And then we didn't do any realistic things. We didn't have the a stuffed deer brought on, which the property master at Stratford Town Haven couldn't believe we were really playing the play at all. We didn't have the stuffed deer. It was done in 13th century costume, and all the ladies had to have their eyebrows taken out, not plucked, but painted out and put about an inch higher. And mine are by nature an inch higher than anybody else's, so I really didn't have to have that done. But
you were born to express surprise.
Yes, well, I'm continually surprised, I must say, at the theatre and my 50 years on it. That is a continual subject of surprise.
Nowadays, young actors' great ambition is to get into one of the repertory companies, I think the National Theatre or the Royal Shakespeare Company. Do you regret that when you were young there were not more of these high-powered, serious repertory companies which one could grow in?
Oh, yes, indeed. I think that's I think the young folk nowadays have a marvellous time. They've equity to defend them. They've got subsidised theatres. They have freedom to choose what they like to do. They can augment their salaries with gorgeous little commercials, which I believe pay untold gold. They can do an occasional television. How fortunate they all are, and do they deserve it? I have the highest opinion of the young on the stage now.
And you think this results in better standards of acting or not? Do you think the
Yes. Oh, I think the standard of acting is incomparably better than in my youth. You see, I came in for a very bad period. I was after your great figures, like Henry Irving and Ellen Terry. I did see Irving, of course, and I knew Ellen. My career hadn't started, and I came in for this quite terrible interwar period of bad plays, of conventional acting, of just making money, of regarding the theatre as pure entertainment, with this undercurrent of these societies to give it the name, really, of art at all.
How much do styles of acting change? Can you, remembering your time in the theatre, notice radical differences, by which I mean supposing Beerbohm Tree or Benson or Ben Greet or any of the people who were great figures when you were beginning, supposing we could now see them, would they look very odd indeed to us?
Oh, very odd indeed, yes. Now, I can remember Charles Wyndham making an exit from the footlights, walking backwards upstage to a door, which, of course, he couldn't see as he was walking backwards, giving good advice to two people who were conveniently placed downstage, one on his right and one on his left. And when he got up to the right position, he put his hand behind him, still not seeing the door, and knew exactly where the handle was, opened it, threw it open, said his final marvellous line, and went off to a roar of applause. And it took me years to get into the modern habit of saying your final line and then walking off, because you couldn't get off unless you were at the door, whether it was to start your own round when you got out of sight, or whether it was that, of course, it does have a dramatic kick if you can say your last line and be out of sight.
Yeah.
But nobody would have thought of walking from the middle of the stage, having said something, going off as we do.
One of the failures of Between the War acting, I have the impression, not having seen it, was a tremendously subdued sort of almost bashful quality as being the official conventional way of acting. Is this right?
Yes, because you see, that was the climate of the times. You had to be unobtrusive. You mustn't look in any way conspicuous. I mean, I was brought up to think that a well-dressed woman was one whom you didn't know what she was wearing. Well, you see, that's hardly anything that helps you to make a sudden violent impact on other people. Any man was supposed not to boast, not to be noticeable. The stiff upper lip, and biting back emotion. Well, all this is jolly nice for the English gentleman, and I should think jolly good for empire building, which is what we were doing. But for acting, it's very hampering.
One of the things which has certainly altered in your almost 60 years of acting is that when you began, I imagine no play started without the curtain rising in a proscenium arch. And now many different things can happen. And you yourself have been at Chichester on a peninsula stage and have been at Pembroke Theatre Croydon when it was a theatre in the round with the audience on all four sides of you. As an actress, how do you feel about this different arrangement of the audience?
Well, I think try everything once, you know, but possibly not twice. I personally don't like being in physical contact with my audience. I don't like smelling my audience as I run down between the serried rows to make my entrance. I don't like being aware of them physically. And I like to see them through a romantic haze of light, as I hope they see me through a romantic haze of light. I found it exceedingly difficult at Chichester, having a wig which was about 1 yard wide, in making more than a third of the audience see me at any given time. A theatre in the round is quite idiotic in my view, because I've always got my back to somebody. I feel so rude, I want to apologise, I want to keep spinning round to get my line in every corner. I frankly can't see the point. I don't like a theatre which is played in a proscenium with the curtain up when I get in. And when my grandson says to me, "Why is the curtain up?" thinking they've forgotten to pull it down, I am speechless because I don't know the answer. Perhaps he's very young, he'll find out the answer. I never shall.
Well, let's move to films. You've made a great many films ever since the talkies began. And did you also make silent films before that?
Yes, I made silent films. It was an extraordinary thing to do because, you see, we had to move our mouths and say things which were not heard at all. We were told the kind of layout of the scene and what it was about and where we should go. And then we were just left to talk. And one I remember that I made with Faye Compton, she was particularly naughty and particularly clever in the medium. And we were playing a scene, a very serious scene, in which she was a great woman financier. And I was kneeling at her feet listening to the words of wisdom. And what she was actually saying was, "Darling, aren't you frightfully hungry? I don't think I shall be able to last out. Why doesn't that idiot of a director let us go now?" Well, you see, it necessitated a form of acting which was really sort of sleight of hand, because one mustn't smile, one mustn't show anything, and it was really quite a gift she had. I don't think I ever quite had it to the same extent.
But did the director tell one just roughly how long to talk nonsense? I mean, he must have been interested in how long the love scene or the drama scene lasted.
Oh, yes, but he shouted his directions, you see, because nothing was heard. "Go on, move. No, no, not so far, dear, and round the court. That's right. Look out there. Look out."
And was it all very small-scale and chaotic or not?
Tiny. We were at Elstree. There were a few little huts in a field, and one walked along to the studio on duckboards if it had been raining very hard, and one was paid at the end of the day in cash in a little office in another little hut. And I remember dear Ernest Thesiger was dying to know how much I was paid every day. I was very interested about what he was paid. So he used to lurk about in the passage until he saw me go in to the treasurer's room and then suddenly emerge as I was counting the last one or two of my pounds. Oh, that belongs to lovely, far-off amateur days.
Do you consciously act differently in different media? I mean, does that come naturally, or do you feel you're doing much the same job?
Well, I feel I'm doing the same job, but I know jolly well I'm not. You see, when one's under the dominion of the machine, when the cameraman is in command of what shall be seen and what shall not be seen, you would think that it didn't matter what you were doing on certain bits of the paper, because he wasn't looking at you at all, and it's all completely wasted energy. I was brought up to try and sustain a part and never to come out of the character, and so I go on fruitlessly acting in a corner when nobody's paying the slightest attention to me.
In your book, The Craft of Comedy, you analyse a scene from Congreve's Love for Love in a way which is, to me, exactly the way of a director. The way you've looked into the scene is a director's way. And you have also directed at least two plays. Do you wish you'd done more directing? Do you like directing?
Do you know, I think I would have been a very good director. I think, in a way, I had bad luck. I know what's my great fault. I don't see a play visually. I love beautiful settings and clothes and lighting, but I'm not enraptured by it. I really am interested in the acting. And I think if you haven't got particularly now that a talent and interest in the visual side, it hampers you very much indeed. But, you know, for some reason, women aren't good directors. They are good directors, but they're not successful.
You obviously, from the way you write your book, are very capable of conceiving the outline and even the detail of a finished performance from reading a part in a play. When you go to a rehearsal, have you in your mind done anything of this sort, and have you a clear concept of what you aim to do with this part?
Oh, yes, I think I know exactly the sort of person I'm going to try to be. I always have to know what I'm going to look like first. But I hope I'm able to take direction insofar as if my conception of the part is not what the producer wants, I can alter it. But that, of course, is not easy for an experienced actress. It's too fundamentally shaking. You are engaged possibly because your director knows what you're going to bring to it. And apart from subtleties or adapting yourself to the other people. And now that's the most interesting thing in me that I find in acting, is the fact that one's performance alters because of the person one's playing with. You get your inspiration from the actor you're with. You get sometimes a view of the character from the person that you're playing with. And that's why, although I know the kind of person I want to portray, this person will only emerge in sympathy with the person who's playing the big scenes with me.
But to what extent then now, when in a way the director is very much one of the stars of the whole theatrical world, the great names in direction from perhaps Tyrone Guthrie onwards are stars in their own right, do you find rehearsing under famous directors that there is a basic clash between your wishes as an actor and theirs as a director sometimes?
No, I haven't ever felt that. With Tony Guthrie, I take what he says as being absolute gospel for me, because he's a greater director than I am an actress. And when he says to me, "Now, Athene, you don't need any Athene Sila tricks here," although I don't quite know what he means, I gather that he means I've got to be simpler and forget the things that go in commercial theatre. And I trust him, and I know how much he taught me in that way.
When you started, say, rehearsing under an actor-manager like Alexander, was anyone regarding it as their business to help you create something from within yourself in this role, or were you rather left on your own to do what you fancied?
It was a question of giving their moods. Of course, in general, he'd say, "My dear, that's too loud," or Can't you move more quickly here? Oh, that's a particularly unfortunate attitude you've adopted there. Or don't stand in front of me and you've taken my light. That is as far as I remember the extent of direction that I had.
Were you at all aware of having any sense of grudge that the whole production was being tailored to show off one man, as many of them were?
Oh, but of course not, because he was a little god to one. One adored and reverenced and venerated him or her. And perhaps I was unusual in this, but it was like a little kingdom, and you were there to serve.
Do you think that the memory people have later, I mean, even many years later, of great performers can be really at all closely connected with that performer? I'm wondering whether something survives in theatrical memory to pass on the torch.
Yes, well, something must, but very few people leave any mark. Mostly, of course, a theatrical reputation has gone within 10 years. In 10 years, it is a new public, and they possibly never heard of the people. You'll find this, and it's really very disorganizing to find that your dearest friend is not remembered or has ever been heard of by the young people who come to dine with your grandson. There are just a few who, for some reason, have caught the public fancy and memory. You have to play the great classic roles to be remembered. Now that. And I tried to get Charles Hawtrey to play in Shakespeare because I told him, you will never be remembered if you don't. Didn't take my advice. Pity.
Looking back over your own time in the theatre, is it at all possible to say what the theatre has meant to you? What is the great joy of it to you? Is there a central attraction to you in the whole business?
It's the joy of telling something that I want to tell to a lot of people who like hearing what I'm going to say. It's my contact with an audience. I think that's the lovely thing about a theatre, is the fact that you are in touch with people. And that's why perhaps films are just for me a method of appeasing my bank manager. Because I'm not in touch with anybody except the cameraman and the lighting man, who I like very much, are very kind to me. Otherwise, what I'm trying to say or do, I'm speaking into a void. And so the theatre resolves itself, for me, into human contacts.
To just throw it to you at the end, one thing which you said in your book, which was that a great performer or a star, and I quote you, must breathe, eat, and dream the theatre. I have never known a successful actor do less. This will limit him as a person and as a citizen. Do you regard yourself as having gone so far in your dedication to theatre that it has limited you as a person and a citizen?
Well, very certainly. I'm not in that category at all. No. For me, a sunset is a sunset or a background to my grandchildren playing on the lawn. It isn't a backcloth. And everything in life I do is related mostly to my family. The theatre is, oh dear, how shall one say it, one's native heath. It's the place where I have spent my long life and very happily. And I trust perhaps a little usefully, that's all.